Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and right next to me is a man that believes Thanksgiving is just an elaborate conspiracy to sell lots of turkey. He is the king of the cover-ups, Mr. Coast to Coast, the captain.
It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Captain.
Yeah. It's a glorified Thursday. But hey, there'll be football.
There will be football. Lots of football, lots of food, and of course, some drinks. So happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there.
Speaking of drinks,
this week, Captain, we are drinking Mr. President by BrewDog.
El Presidente.
That's right. Garage grade, 4 out of 5 bottle caps.
Mm-hmm.
Say hello to the president-elect of double IPAs.
Hello.
This beer is a superpower flexing its hoppy muscles. Mr. President is a delicious double IPA that is full on and full tilt flavor and is brought to us by some of our wonderful garage guys and girls out there. First up, we have Juanita in Newfoundland, Canada, as well as Christine in Calgary, Canada. Lots of Canada today. There's also Adria in Seattle, Washington, who says much love to the captain and Nick, but she says she's sending extra love to the captain. So
right.
It sounds like you have an admirer.
All right.
Also,
extra love for me.
We have Jessica in Twin Falls, Idaho. Let's go down south and give a shout out to Nicole in Raleigh, North Carolina.
All right.
Next, we have Robert from Denver, Colorado. Robert says, Nick, keep your head up. Your Browns will be good again. Yeah, Robert, I'm not so sure about that. I'm now rooting for the Raiders. I got the silver and black.
You know what I was thinking? True Crime Garage, we're like the Cleveland Browns of True Crime Podcast.
Setting the bar low.
One day we're gonna be great. One day.
Setting the bar low and lowering it week after week. So, and last but not least, we have Ian in Cambridgeshire, United Kingdom. I love the UK because you notice that all the town names seem to sound like something out of The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
So a big thanks to everybody that helped make our week a little more great by kicking it up for the beer fund. And if you want to buy us around for next week's show.
For next week's show.
Go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button. Buy us some beer.
And
we'll just keep putting out shows. That's how it works. It's simple, you know, like the guy on the side of the road that has the sign that says, we'll work for food.
Uh-huh.
Well, we got a sign that says, we'll work for beer.
We will podcast for beer. Yeah. So I guess this year I'm very thankful for people listening to the show.
I'm thankful for the garage.
So while you're listening to this, right, I'm thankful for you. For you.
That's right. Treat yourself to a nice glass of wine.
Treat yourself, fool.
Big mug of beer on Thanksgiving and have a safe and happy holiday.
Yeah, thank you so much. And as always, we like your gym.
For everything True Crime Garage, go to truecrimegarage.com. And while you're there, make sure you sign up on the mailing list.
And that's enough of the business.
That's right. Gather around, grab a chair, and grab a beer.
Grab a turkey.
Let's talk some true crime.
I hope somebody has their leftover turkeys and they're making their nice turkey sandwich with the mayonnaise, you know, all that.
All right, turkey grabber. Let's talk some true crime.
Get in the garage.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, There is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program. For from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
This week marks the 53rd anniversary of the assassination of our 35th president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He was shot and murdered in Dallas, Texas at the young age of 46. Now, we're not here to talk about that today, but I'm sure we're going to end up talking about it at some point.
Yeah, at some point, but we're going to have to spend like half a year talking about that.
Well, it's this time of year, and it happens every year, where you start seeing, you know, on A&E and all the documentary-style channels, that we start seeing things coming out, oh, new information about the JFK assassination, and, oh, this has been uncovered, and now we're going to show you a different documentary that's actually the same one you watched last year. We just changed it a little bit. So we have this every year in the late November, just before Thanksgiving. We are reminded of what took place in Dallas, Texas back in the 60s and
63.
You know, we're reminded year after year after year. And this has been a huge topic of much debate ever since that day in Dallas, Texas. But today we are here to talk about Mary Pinchot Meyer. Mary Pinchot was born October 14th, 1920 in New York City, New York. She attended and graduated Vassar College. She went on to meet Cord Meyer Jr. in 1944. Cord had served in the United States Marine Corps during World War II, and he was a bit of a war hero. But as a young man, he seemed to be more of a peace lover, of someone that didn't really believe in war. And it seems that maybe the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor had changed him, and that is when he decided to sign up for the Marines. He fought in the Pacific War, and he saw plenty of action. He was wounded in war, losing his left eye due to a grenade attack. For this, Cord was awarded the Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Cord and Mary were married in April of 1945, and they would have three children, all boys. After the war, Cord began a career in writing, and he was writing for the Atlantic Monthly. And he penned a couple of books as well, even winning an award for his efforts.
Well, this war, World War II, was different than a lot of the wars that we're involved in now. And, you know, we stayed out of the war for so long. And it was, you know, we were united as a country for the, you know, the majority of people really understood why we're fighting World War II.
Well, and this is why they went on to become the greatest generation.
You don't think, like, maybe the millennials will be better
than them? No. Who knows? Maybe. Hopefully, yes. I mean, if this was the greatest generation, ideally, you want our country to keep getting better and people as a whole to get better. So, you know, let's step it up a little bit, people. Going back to the story here. So, While he's working as an author, and he would eventually apply for a position with the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Now, Cord he's an ideal candidate back then in the 50s for a position in the CIA, right? He's a decorated war hero. He's very smart. He's an Ivy Leaguer. He's the kind of people that they wanted to fill their offices with and fill these positions with. Cord, of course, gets the job, and the Meyers pick up and they move to Washington, D.C.
Well, you're making it sound a little simpler than it was. I mean, yeah, he applied for this position, but there's no, I mean, he essentially was working for the CIA for an amount of time. They don't know how long.
Yeah, like, there's some discrepancy on when he actually officially started working for the CIA.
Yeah, so it's not as simple as, well, this guy applied for the CIA, and then therefore now he's working for the CIA. No, at some point he was working for the CIA, and then at some point the CIA made that official.
Well, as with the CIA, wouldn't you? I mean, I fully believe that they fully disclose everything, right? There's no yeah. mystery there. So, yeah, of course, we don't know exactly when he started, but when he officially started, they moved to Washington, D.C., and they are now, the Meyers are living near a very busy road. And in 1954, the family dog was crossing this busy street and was struck and killed by a car. Now, the strange foreshadowing here is that just 2 years later, in 1956, The same would be the fate of Cord and Mary's middle son, 9-year-old Michael. Michael was returning home with his older brother. This was late in the year, December 18th in 1956. Now, this is the time of the year when, you know, it's very dark. It gets very dark early. And this was a busy street, and it was not well lit. Most likely, the driver never saw the young boy racing across the street. Little Michael was killed pretty much instantly. Now, Mary was notified by her eldest son, who runs to the scene of the accident. And this kind of shows me what kind of person Mary was. Mary gets to the scene, and while she's there, she comforts the driver of the vehicle that hit her boy.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, it's interesting too, because one, a lot of people would say, well, man, there's conspiracy already happening, right? We have a CIA official son, you know, hit by a car and dies, and would show some evidence of, oh, well, maybe this is a conspiracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there doesn't look that way. You see what I'm saying?
No, this appears to be completely an accident. And you know, as we said, it's not something that, when I say the word accident, I don't say that lightly, because we saw just 2 years before the dog is hit on the same street, roughly mm-hmm. about the same time of year. So there, this is a street where maybe the only conspiracy is, why isn't there street lights?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it's also the 50s, right? So, I mean, it's a different time. They didn't have streetlights on every street.
But I think this is very telling of who Mary Pinchot Meyer was. You know, when I had heard about this case many years ago, but didn't really, you know, sometimes when you hear about these cases or read something on something and you don't really dive into it, it's hard to identify with the people as people. And, you know, once I got to dive into this case, I got to see really who she was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and she was very smart, charismatic, and an affectionate person as well. She was an artist, and she was a socialite, very, very involved in the different social circles of the time, and very up to date on her ideals and beliefs about where the world was heading and what direction our government in our country should be heading.
Well, she was a lady, you know, before her time. You know,
you're exactly right.
You know, she was, you know, not the typical. They talk about this a lot. In the 50s, you know, women after high school, or if they did go to college, which a lot of them wouldn't go, but they would get a job, but that job was just a placeholder until they found a man, and then they got married, and then they would stay at home and raise their kids. That was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the norm for Mary at all. You know, she would get a job that she would dive into and make it into a career, going from a bunch of different facets in her life.
Now, there was some trouble going on in the marriage even before the death of their son. And there was, you know, I don't know how much you want to get into rumors, but it sounds like when they first got married, when Cord and Mary first met one another, that they probably shared a lot of the same ideals and a lot of the same thoughts on things we just mentioned about the direction of the world and where our government and our nation should be helping to lead in that direction. Mm-hmm. She was a big peace lover and had no problem expressing that with most. Now, I said there were some trouble in the marriage, and it seems like that Cord, once he had been working for the CIA for a while, he became, I don't know how much of a drinker he was beforehand, but the stuff that I've been reading is saying that he was kind of changing a bit,
yeah.
that he was drinking more and more. And of course, the death of the child did not help this situation at all.
No.
Before any of
because the percentage of people that can stay together after loss of a child is very low,
mm-hmm.
and rightfully so, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so now you have this guy, you know, the death of his son, But that's probably weighing on her too. But now he's in the CIA, and now what is he learning in the CIA, and how much is that affecting, you know, his mental makeup?
And he had been involved in something called Operation Mockingbird.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's unclear to me whether he was kind of the...
The speculation is that he was the head of it.
He spearheaded this thing.
Mm-hmm. Like, we see the work that you're doing a good job, and therefore we want you to spearhead this operation.
Yeah, and he had a bit of notoriety for being in charge of this operation or spearheading.
Okay, so let's talk about what...
Operation Mockingbird.
Because I mean, it doesn't matter. Hey, he spearheaded this.
Well,
nobody cares unless there's some, you know, some. This is a weird operation.
Yeah. So here's the gist of it, right? Okay. So from my understanding, that what the CIA was doing was they were getting in the pockets of people that were working in different areas for different newspapers, and this way, when a story would come about, they might have an opportunity to skew it in the direction that they would like, especially if they wanted something to put the CIA into a good light or have a good ring about it, so to say. And this may have even carried over to radio and eventually TV as well, I'm assuming. One doesn't really know, one being me, the extent of this operation and how far it carried. I wonder, you know, you definitely know it was happening in Washington, D.C., and it was probably happening in other major areas, that being New York, Chicago, L.A., things of that nature.
All right. So, but let's make this clear. Okay. So one of the big conspiracies that people talk about these days is this whole Illuminati, right? People talk about the Illuminati. And one of the things that people talk mostly about the Illuminati is that they are controlling media, and that they will also control arts and things of that nature. And the overall idea is that if we put out all this dumb garbage, that you'll be so consumed with dumb garbage, and we're not putting out this idea that you need to be a thinker, that you need to dive into things, you need to be an intellect. You need to care what's going on. And therefore, if you don't really give a shit what's going on and you're just stuck on your phone all day, that the government can do whatever the hell it wants to do. And then that, and the other governments can do whatever the hell they want to do. And a lot of people will say, well, this idea is completely crazy, right? But now in the 50s, we have this operation called Operation Mockingbird. And here's what it was, you know, to simplest forms. It was a plan to influence domestic and foreign media. So to influence domestic and foreign media, whatever level that is. But see how there's, you would have some weight to the conspiracy of today going all the way back to the 50s.
Well, and the thing we got to point out here too, is this Operation Mockingbird was not, this is not a theory. This happened. This absolutely happened. We don't know the extent of it. And, you know, the conspiracy theorists can run with that as much as they like. But again, this did happen. This was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly right. You know, it's the old thought that, you know, if you can control speech, you can control thought. And you know what? If we can change these stories and manipulate them any way that we choose, well, guess what, Mr. Citizen? You don't have to do the thinking, because we've already done the thinking for you. So just sit back and be entertained and enjoy the ride.
Right. And we're going to control the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Again, their marriage was having some issues beforehand. And Mary had confided in Cord that she had gone outside of the marriage. It's rumored that Cord had as well, but there's no hard evidence of that. But regardless, the death of his son and this problem with their marriage did not help his drinking at all.
Right.
And he basically became kind of a mean, bitter drunk. And what would end up happening is that they would get a divorce in 1958. Cord believed that, you know, there's some journals that he kept, and he had wrote in there that he thought that maybe the death of their son, this might reunite them, so to speak, that
right.
they might, you know, need to team up to get each other through this tragic event. That ended up not being the case, just divorcing 2 years after the death of their son.
But like, I mean, I want to put some emphasis on the idea that, you know, Mary was ahead of her time. She wasn't going to be some lady or some female just to get married and to be her husband's sidekick. She was not interested in that. At least that's what it looks like from the outsider's point of view.
Now, it should be noted here that in 1954, the Kennedys, John Fitzgerald and his wife, and one day First Lady Jackie Kennedy, they buy the house next door to the Myers. This is, again, in 1954, before the Myers divorced in 1958. Now, this is where we get into an issue of how big this story could be. I mean, it's a big story with lots of layers, right? Now, on the surface, it has been reported that Mary Pinchot Meyer and Jackie Kennedy were friends and that they even took walks together.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. And maybe they took some walks together. But the more I kept digging, it sounds to me like they were not friends. Maybe they were friendly to one another, but they were probably simply just acquaintances.
Right.
After Mary's divorce, Mary still had possession of the house for some time, and she rented the home to a young woman who was having an affair with Mr. John Kennedy. And it's hard to put an exact date on it.
Wait, okay, so they get a divorce, the Myers, right?
Yeah.
And she keeps the house that is next to JFK, and then she rents it out to a lady.
Yeah.
And a single lady.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know who that lady is.
I don't have the lady's name, but a little backstory on that is that that Jack Kennedy had approached Mary and asked her if they could rent the home. Now, this was going to be to somebody that would fill the role of some form of secretary. I don't know if she was a secretary to John F. Kennedy, but I believe she may have been a secretary to Jackie, actually.
Okay.
And now this young woman, much younger than Jack Kennedy at the time, she was working for them in some capacity, and she was also having an affair with him.
Right.
So Mary was aware of the things going on in and out of the Kennedy marriage. There are plenty of rumors on both sides. And when I say both sides, I mean Mary and her social circle, yeah, as well as JFK and his social circle, that JFK was pursuing Mary.
Well, it seemed like JFK just sleep with everybody.
Yeah, actually, he is my father. No, but he, so it's no.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. And I'm going to run for office next year.
I mean, he just seems like the biggest whore. Of all
time. he was it's tough for me because I've always I think he was a
I looked up to him.
Had the makings to be a great leader, but he probably was not a great man outside of the office.
No shit. I mean, he
was definitely not a good husband.
He's a whore.
All right, well, we all know about JFK and what he was doing, but there's plenty of rumor that we can back up that he was pursuing Mary and he had an interest in her. And it's unclear if she was willing in the early, you know,
right,
in the early portions of this. But at some point, and this would be in the year of 1961, there's plenty of evidence to support that an affair between Mary and JFK had started sometime in the year of 1961. Now, at this point, obviously, right, JFK is the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And there's speculation on both sides. I mean, because this was what was so difficult for me, is trying to figure out. I mean, it was just kind of like his side said, oh, yeah, we think something was going on. And some people that knew her believe it was going on. I don't know how much evidence there is to prove that.
You know, well, if there are a few pictures that show them together, which doesn't mean together.
Right, it doesn't show them having sex. It shows them hanging out. To me, this is just my gut feeling on the situation, this was a lady that was ahead of her time, and this was a lady that had, not, you know, all ladies had at that time thoughts of their own, but most women weren't capable of speaking them or wanting to speak them. And she was, and she was this free thinker, artist type, thinking outside the box, some kind of revolutionary ideas. And I think that was attractive to him. And I think she was like, eh, you don't get what you want. You know, you might get these other girls, but you don't get me.
Yeah. And
that's my gut feeling, is that he was pursuing her and she's going, eh, not so much.
And I think you're exactly right. I think that would be the appeal. I mean, not only is she very attractive, but she's somebody that is as smart as every man in the room, you know,
or smarter.
And the other thing too, just like you had said, she was ahead of her time. You know, a lot of times when there's trouble in a marriage back in the 50s and 60s, the wife would usually wait around and wait for the man to divorce her. That was not the situation in this case. Everything that I could find sound like she was the one that decided, hey, this is when, you know, we're getting a divorce. This marriage is not working for either of us, and we're going to get a divorce. I'm the one calling this to action. And in fact, she had actually taken a trip to Europe. I don't know if it was for several weeks or for a month, but she went off to Europe with the thought that, you know what, my marriage sucks. And so I'm either going to go to Europe, right, and I'm going to have a good time, and I'm going to get away from my husband.
Sounds like a good time.
And I'm going to come back. And when I come back, I'm going to know whether I want to remain in this marriage or not. It's that I need some time by myself to figure this thing out. And when she came back, she's decided, you know what, it's not working. We're getting a divorce.
Which again, and I don't mean to harp on this point too much, but in 2016, that's not that crazy of a idea. I'm going to go to Europe for a little bit to clear my head, see if I want to stay in this marriage. But in the 50s, that seems like a pretty crazy idea, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it shows her personality. It shows her intelligence. And to me, she was a woman of means, though. You know, she had the ability to do some of these things. You know, sure that most people, whether it be men or woman, would not have had that opportunity back then or even today. But it does show that she is ahead of her time. And again, the appeal that, you know, Cord Meyer was in his own right, a powerful man.
Yeah.
You know, this is not just some, you know, some low level dude that she married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a war hero. He's a celebrated war hero. He was an author. And he had a high ranking job in the CIA. I know there's some debate about.
Yeah, he's the original level. Carl. But And you would think that there would be a lot of appeal for women to want to be around this guy, too, a war hero and in the CIA. Tons of power, money, power.
And that goes back to why I think that she might not have been friends with Jackie Kennedy. And my whole thought on this is that, you know, time and time again, when I am reviewing Mary's personality, she seems to be someone to me of a person of standards, high standards, as well as, morals and moral values. You know, we see her comforting the person that accidentally killed her young child. And I believe that she may have just known Jackie Kennedy, that she would not have had this affair with JFK had she actually been friends with Jackie. You know, some of the little snippets that you will read
that's
about.
That's a weird thought, though. Well, she's okay with having an affair, but she's not okay with an affair if she's friends with the wife.
But the only reason why I bring that up is because when you first glance at this case, if you just bring up a quick little snippet about it, the first thing they say in every article is her and Jackie were friends. Like they go out of their way to bring that up very early in the story. And what I'm getting at is when you dive into it further and you review it as a whole, it doesn't really appear that she was friends with Jackie Kennedy. It appears like she was friends with John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's weird though to me because there's actually proof that she's maybe not friends, but she's trying to influence the women of the of the people of power, the men of power in Washington, she's trying to influence their wives or their women or their mistresses. She talks, and we'll talk about Timothy Leary later, but so there is some kind of proof of that. But and maybe I'm dead wrong, and maybe there's like some solid proof of this affair between her and John. But to me, it seems like this is a guy that's pursuing her, and she's saying no,
mm-hmm.
constantly no.
Right.
And again, I could be dead wrong on that.
Well, but here's okay. So there, what is the proof of the affair? Because you know, I don't want to go into this case wondering if that is, you know, is that the major topic of discussion? No, that's not.
No,
the major topic of discussion is her murder and why that took place.
Yeah.
And who did it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we have this beautiful lady, intelligent lady, ahead of her time, connected to people of power, connected to the president. She's connected to drug experimentation. She's connected to the CIA. And this lady goes for a walk, and she ends up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's unsolved to this day.
Right. And I think this is where we address the affair. You know, we talked about the back and forth of it. However, you know, what is some evidence of this? Is this just her saying that she slept with the president? No. It's you know, through decades of since the assassination, there's been many authors come out with books talking about this affair. And
right.
The first time that we see this kind of come and presented to the masses is in 1976. Now, this was a National Enquirer article, right? And now everybody's going, oh my God, Nick just said that this is true because the National Enquirer reported wow. on it. However,
nobody likes you anyways, right?
Right. But we got to keep in mind that the article, this is how this thing gets out to the masses, okay? The Myers, Cord and Mary Meyer,
yeah.
were both friends with James Truett and Anne Truett. Now, who are they? Well, James Truett was a well-known writer for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And
like we said, Cord Meyer wrote some articles before.
And I believe that James Truett either penned the article that would later be in the National Enquirer, or he was the subject of the article.
Right.
Now,
or maybe the source.
Yeah. And Truett, what had happened after the death of JFK, Truett on occasion had gotten drunk in public, and he would kind of spout off at the mouth about this affair that had been going on between JFK and Mary Pinchot Meyer.
Right.
And so the other thing here is that that's not just the only evidence, you know, because that's pretty much hearsay, but there's a lot of hearsay. And what that is we see many people in her social circles that say that this affair took place.
Mm-hmm.
And we even see people in JFK's social circles that say that this affair took place. There are references to Jack having said things to other men of power in the White House, you know, about how fond he was of Mary and how Mary might be a person that would be hard to live with because she was so forward thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also,
could you imagine the fear of the 1950s male? You know, can't have a woman with an opinion. You know how hard that would be. You know how hard that would be to live with. I mean, come on.
Well, and the other thing is there is evidence once JFK was in the White House. Why? Because we have the Secret Service involved who has to monitor the president and his movements and his visitors. And what we see time and time again in the beginning, there was a visitor that was always labeled as, you know, this would be for dinner parties or for visits to the White House to see the president, sometimes in closed doors. And this would be David Powers plus one. Well, Mary Pinchot Meyer was the plus one.
Right.
And the thing they did there was it was trying to give the illusion to whoever may be monitoring the situation that David Powers was the actual visitor and his plus one was his date.
Right.
Where actually what we would see later, and this is all recorded by the Secret Service, that eventually the plus one didn't drop off from David Powers' visits. Eventually, David Powers dropped off from the plus one's visits, and we would just start seeing Mary Meyer or Mary Pinchot at this time, now visiting the president on her own.
What do you think David felt when they're like, hey, you don't need to show up anymore? Or was he the guy that said, you know what? I can't keep driving her around for your booty calls.
And I'm just sitting outside the door looking at my watch.
He's probably just and he's screaming at the White House, JFK, you dirty whore.
Well, and I think in the beginning, a lot of these visits were for dinner parties or for dinners.
Yeah.
Where you would typically have a plus one. But, you know, we see over a dozen visits in the short time that JFK was in the White House where Mary Pinchot was a visitor to see JFK.
Yeah.
So to further the speculation, and actually more importantly, to further the weight to provide validation to this affair rumor.
Between Mary Meyer and JFK.
Even earlier this year, we saw better proof of that, right? There was an unsent letter that was discovered.
Yeah, and so in June of this year, it was auctioned off for just under $89,000.
That's a lot of rolling papers.
That is a lot of cheddar for an unsent letter.
Yeah, and so how does this come about? This was stored by JFK's secretary in a safe somewhere, and it was never sent to Mary Pinchot, but was thought to be written for her.
Yeah, so the idea was roughly about a month before JFK's assassination in 1963, he wrote this letter. It was on president letterhead or White House letterhead. The letterhead was actually cut off. They believe that, like, you know, if he'd sent a private message and he didn't want, like, some backtrack, right? You know, we can't backtrack it to him. Now, a lot of people then speculate, well, okay, one, why wasn't it sent? Because it was never sent. And was it actually from John F. Kennedy? They did a watermark test based on his pen. I think they had the like old school like dipping pins or the fountain pens, and so they could tell that it was his watermark, which was interesting. So let's just dive into this letter a little bit. Okay, so this is what it reads.
So it's a 4-page note, basically.
Yeah, it's not super long.
And some have deemed this as a almost begging letter to mistress, right? So why don't you read what is believed that JFK wrote?
And if you look this up on the internet, I'll try to post pictures on Instagram about this, and you can find those on the website as well, just so you can see it. I had to look up a transcription of this because it was so hard to read. I mean, not only was he a dirty whore, but I mean, his penmanship was awful. Okay, so it says, why don't you leave suburbia for once? Come and see me. Well, maybe I should read it like this. Be like Barry White. Why don't you leave suburbia for once? Come and see me, either here or at the Cape next week, or in Boston the 19th. I know it is unwise, irrational, and that you may hate it. On the other hand, you may not, and I will love it. You say it is good for me not to get what I want. After all these years, you should give me a more loving answer than that. Why don't you just say yes? Now, some people say it's a love letter.
And he just signed it J. With the letter J.
Yo, J.
Well, and it could be a love letter. I mean, not only the thought was that there was this affair between the two of them.
Sounds like a very insensitive love letter if it's a love letter. It was not like, you know, you smell so good, I love your hair.
Yeah, but
you
know, I don't.
I like to cuddle with you.
But again, let's think of Mary's personality.
I like to be Big Spoon if you'd be Little Spoon.
Do you think Mary would even bother with a person that would write things like that? I think that she...
I don't know. I think you'd have a better chance than writing that dog shit.
Well, he's just asking her to come and visit him.
No, basically what he's saying is like, look, I know you might not like it. I know it's unwise and irrational, but it's a booty letter. That's all it is. Come see me. Here's an option. Here's an option. I'm not going to put that much time and effort. I am going to put two paragraphs on four pages. What do you think that is? If you have two paragraphs and you put it on four pages, it's because you had nothing to say. And so you wanted to put four. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have nothing to say to you. So to make it seem like it's more important, I put it on more pages. I write bigger.
Or do you think it was maybe it was just going to be a one-note
letter? No, I think he was drunk. I think he was drunk and thinking, man, that Mary Meyer, she is so sexy with her thoughts and opinions.
But again, regardless of your opinion of it being a booty letter or whatever, it there is thought there that with this affair, that this was not just an affair for JFK. You know, we knew he had many tryst and many things outside of the many indiscretions outside of his marriage. And but the thought was by his friends, by the people that knew him best, that this was somebody that he actually had an emotional relationship with.
Well, and look, that might be the case. I'm just saying that letter has no proof of that. There's not like, I love you. It doesn't, there's no, nothing complimentary in the letter.
Right. I mean,
nothing at all. There's not one thing that's complimentary.
I can agree with that. But again, I think there are some things to point out that he may have been in love with her in some fashion. More so than, you know, where some of these other affairs were just.
Yeah, but that's flames. That's what I'm saying. So frustrating about history in general or cases in general is when they go, well, he loved her. Okay, where's the proof? Well, we got this love letter. And then you read the love letter and it's not a love letter. That's my problem with it. Well, where's the proof? Oh, well, his friend said so. And then we got this love letter. It's not a love letter. Like I said, there is nothing remotely complimentary there at all.
I agree. But what I'm saying is that the level of their relationship is important to Mary's story, to her murder. Because the thought is that if her murder was some kind of conspiracy,
right,
that she would have had to just been something more than a fling, that she would have, for an organization or a group of people to conspire to murder her and cover it up, it's because she had to have known something that others didn't. And you talked about how big of a whore JFK was, let's say, right?
Right, whore.
So then there should be women dropping dead all over the United States if there's not something more.
Right,
to
but
this.
I think that's I think that kind of talk and that kind of speculation is very dismissive to who Mary Meyer was. It's dismissive to say, well, if there is a conspiracy, if there is something more to her murder, that she had to be in love with JFK or JFK had to be in love with her. And it couldn't just been a fling or something that happened when she was drunk and that maybe she didn't want when she was sober. Look, so I think that minimizes her. Here's what it was. She is married to a CIA, right? High official in CIA, Project Mockingbird, lives next to JFK. And we're not even talking about the Timothy Leary stuff. I think she knew a bunch of people in the inner circle.
Oh, without a doubt.
And she was a woman of power. So that's all the conspiracy theory you need to know. So the fact if JFK was in love with her does not define her story. You know, see what I'm saying?
No, but it adds chapters to her story.
No, I get that. But the thing, but what I'm saying is if that we just assume, like, all I'm saying is maybe they had an affair. Who cares if they're in love? It doesn't matter. You know, the facts are that this person, Mary Meyer, knew a bunch of people of power. She was trying to influence other people with her ideas. This president is assassinated. Tons of conspiracy there. A year later, right? About a year later, the Warren Commission comes out, has their findings, and a couple weeks later, this lady is murdered.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm saying is that minimizes her as a person. If it's like, oh, well, we have to, we have to prove that he loved her or something to make her story valuable.
No, but we don't have to prove that he loved her. What we have to prove is that whether or not her murder was just a random act of violence,
right,
that we see every day in the newspapers, or if it was something organized and put together by a group of people. And if it were to be that, the second, that she would have had to have known something, known somebody, or said something that would have that cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, though. You did lead on to something there that I like. Maybe her death wasn't an attempt to cover up something she knew from JFK. Maybe it was an attempt to cover up something she knew about the CIA from things that she knew from being married to somebody in the CIA.
Right.
But we should get into the day of her death. Now, this is October 12, 1964. Now, at the time, Mary had moved on. She wasn't living in the home that was, you know, formerly next to the Kennedys' old home. And she was working as an artist, and she had a studio, and she would typically go in and do her studio work, and she would leave around lunchtime, around noon every day, and she would take a somewhat lengthy walk. And this was, you know, if the weather was good, she did this every day.
Yeah, she's primarily a painter.
Mm-hmm. So she goes out for her walk, and this is on near the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. And there's a towpath down there. And she would go down there for her walk.
And she's still in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. And around noontime, this is around noontime, but to tell this story properly, we have to introduce a new character.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is Henry Wiggins. Henry Wiggins is a tow truck driver. And Henry Wiggins has an assistant. His name is Bill Branch. And the two of them are called to the 4300 block of Canal Road, and they are going there to fix a stalled vehicle. This is a Nash Rambler. They arrive approximately at 12:20 p.m. Again, this is Monday, October 12, 1964. Now, less than 1 minute after they arrive, Henry Wiggins, he hears the screams of a woman, and he hears these for approximately, he says, 20 seconds.
Are they screams saying anything, or is it just, you know?
Yeah, he says that he had heard, you know, someone help me, please help me, something of that nature.
Right.
And so he decides to run towards the danger, right? He hears these screams for about 20 seconds, which is followed by a gunshot.
Okay.
Now, approximately 10 to 20 seconds later, this is while Henry Wiggins is running toward Canal, he's crossing Canal Road, and he's running toward where he's hearing these screams in the gunshot. So 10 or 20 seconds after the first gunshot, he hears a second gunshot. At this point, Wiggins approaches what has been referred to as the lower wall. And he gets up on this wall, and he peers over. And what he says he sees is he sees an African-American man standing over what appears to be the dead body of a woman.
Uh-huh.
And he identifies the clothing that he sees this African-American man wearing. He says that he sees the man wearing a dark, I want to say ball cap, but it's wearing a dark hat with a light-colored beige long sleeve jacket and dark pants and dark shoes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is 64 too, so ball caps would be less likely.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I just always call them ball caps.
Right.
This is a, you know, hat with a bill.
Good job. Good job.
Thanks. And he says that he sees this man standing over the dead body of a woman. Mm-hmm. Now, he says that the man doesn't seem to be like, you know, he doesn't seem to be doing anything other than standing there. The man's arms are down to his sides.
Right. And no gun in the hand or anything.
He says that he saw something dark in the man's hand.
Right. But
and the man turns and looks at him. Now, at this point, Henry Wiggins is a little more than 100 feet away from the man and from the body.
Okay.
And he sees Henry Wiggins, and he doesn't, like, take off in a sprint. he just kind of briskly walks away. And at this point, Henry Wiggins, he gets down because he's worried now that the man has seen him and he may come after him. So it's phoned in that, that there has been an attack.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, within minutes, the police department arrive on the scene, and they are quick to close off the exits and entrances to this towpath. You would have to take sets of stairs to get down there, and they block off all of these entrances and exits. And during the course of this time, they have sent out the description of the man that they are looking for. They are looking for an African-American man wearing a dark hat, dark trousers, mm-hmm. and a light-colored jacket. So this is within just about 10 minutes to 15 minutes of when the gunshots are originally heard. Now, the police are searching the area, and they've supposedly got it all blocked off, right? And so if the killer is still in the area, he's got no room to escape. He's trapped, and they're going to find him.
They're going to find him if he's still there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they locate a man approximately a little after 1 o'clock. This is might even be closer to 1:15. They locate a man who is matching the description somewhat of the man that they are looking for. The man that they see is a African-American man. He has similar clothes that was described in the call. Now, the man approaches the police officer. The crazy thing here is, though, this man is soaking wet. I guess it's not that crazy because they are near the water, right? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he's soaking wet to the point of when the officer asked the man to identify himself, he says that I am Ray Crump. And not only that, he pulls out his wallet to produce his identification. And when he does that, the officer sees water noticeably dripping from the man's wallet. I mean, he was soaked.
Yeah. And why is he soaked?
Well, that's what the police want to know. The other thing here, too, is the officer notices that the man's zipper on his pants is down, or his fly is open.
Mm.
Now, here's the thing. They ask him where he is, you know, where he was and what he's been doing for the past hour. And he says that he was fishing.
Yeah.
And he was falling asleep on one of the rocks, and because he was down there drinking and fishing. And at some point he had fallen asleep and fallen into the water. And now the officer asked him, you know, where is your fishing gear? You know, where's your rod and reel and your tackle box? And right. He says, well, I don't have any of that because all of that fell into the water as well. And right. I was not able to retrieve that.
And the main, look, you could go fishing with just a pole. So mm-hmm. the main thing is my pole is in the water. Mm-hmm. Right.
And the officer asked the man to take him to where he was fishing, so that he could help him retrieve the fishing rod. They go down to the rock, and Ray Crump says, you know, this is where I was, and, you know, this is where I'd fallen in. And they look, and they don't see any obvious signs of a fishing rod. The man is arrested.
Yeah. Well, I think the cop was going, hey, show me this spot. Show me where you fell in the water, because that's pretty odd.
And keep in mind, he's being arrested because, you know, one, his story isn't matching. It isn't adding up to the officer, first of all. And second of all, he matches the description of the man that they were looking for. Now, at this point, though, he is minus a coat. He's minus the jacket and minus a hat. So they arrest this Mr. Crump, and the thing here, though, is this is where we immediately start to see some discrepancies in the description of the man that they went looking for,
right,
and the man that they have in custody.
Well, and the man they're looking for, we don't know if that is the killer. We just were looking for the guy that the tow truck driver saw standing over Mary's body.
Yes, and a more complete description of the man that Henry Wiggins had seen standing over the dead woman's body is he had seen an African American man between the height of 5'8" and 5'10" tall, approximately 185 pounds, wearing a dark plaid cap, light beige jacket, dark trousers, and dark shoes. Now, Ray Crump, according to his driver's license or to his identification, is 5'3.5", and Jeez. He weighs 130 pounds soaking wet.
5'3"?
5'3.5".
That's a tiny man.
Mm-hmm. When he is arrested, they do note that they list him at 5'5.5". Apparently, he was wearing shoes that he was wearing lifts, basically. Like, so right. he would appear to be of a more normal height, let's say. And he may have been closer to 140 pounds at that time. So police believe that they have their man, right? And the coroner report is going to note that the dead body, the dead woman that was found near the towpath, mm-hmm. was that of Mary Pinchot. And she had been shot twice. She'd been shot once in the head and once in the back. Now, the thing about the shot that went in her back was that it was angled at a way that it pretty much severed her aorta. And she had been killed practically instantly. You know, mm-hmm. so she's not, you know, you heard the screams. She's attacked. She's shot. According to Henry Wiggins, she shot within 10 seconds or 20 seconds of each shot. And, you know, she's not able to provide the police with anything once they arrive because she's already passed. After arresting Mr. Crump, the police continue to search the area. They are now looking for his dark cap and his jacket. They are able to locate items that match these descriptions. However, what they're not able to find is a gun.
Right.
And they never would recover a gun. They would spend lots of time and lots of effort down there looking for the murder weapon. This is never retrieved.
Yeah. Where do they find these? You know, where do they find the cap and the jacket? Do they say where?
Yeah. I believe one of the items, I believe it was the jacket, they were looking for in the water.
Right.
Crump had said that he had lost it in the water or assumed that it had gone into the water. And that was located in the water. Now, the cap, I believe, was found on the ground, and it was found not near the actual murder scene, but it was found closer to where he had said that he was fishing.
Right.
Now, they did a hair sample to determine that this was, in fact, his cap. So he was wearing a hat that day. And this jacket was most likely his. The thing here is, though, there's no gun found, right? And one thing that the police did not do is they did not conduct any tests to determine if Crump had fired a gun that day. The reason being is they are saying that was not necessary because when they found him, he's soaking wet. And this would make the test appear to be negative regardless of the actual truth.
They should have done the test.
You're exactly right. Because
they even found that if you, you know, even if you shower, even if you, you know, use soap and all that stuff, that it normally this test still is positive if you shot a gun that day.
And you're exactly right. And that's why they should have conducted the test, because, you know, the masses know generally now more about how these procedures work and the things mm-hmm. that you should do when a crime is committed and when you're investigating it. I think back then it might have been a little easier to kind of just tell, well, we didn't do this because of this, and the general public may not know any better to question it again. But you're exactly right. There have been plenty of people that have suggested and said that, you know, we've found that even after someone has fired a gun, they could wash their hands a dozen times.
Yeah.
And we're still able to detect the firing of a weapon. About 24 hours after the crime was committed and after the arrest of Ray Crump Jr., a man identifying himself as Army Lieutenant William Mitchell goes to the police. This is October 13, 1964. He goes to the police and he says that he was running. He was a jogger and he would normally take a run, and he had run past Mary Meyer on the CNO canal path, towpath in Georgetown.
Right.
This is just a short time before her murder. He claims that he had seen an African-American man matching the description of Ray Crump Jr., who had already been arrested the day before. That this man was following Mary. This would add to the police already, you know, this would bolster their speculation that Ray Crump Jr. was in fact guilty of the death of Mary Pinchot Meyer.
Right.
What do we have here, Captain? We have a woman, mm-hmm. age 43, 2 days before her birthday, on October 12, 1964.
Intelligent, beautiful lady.
That's right. Respected woman.
Mother.
Artist. She goes out, takes a break from work, as she normally would do every day of the week, and go for a long walk, maybe to catch some fresh air or some inspiration for her art.
Mm-hmm.
And during that walk, she is attacked. She's shot twice. According to the coroner report, she's drugged about 25 feet.
Well, she dies instantly.
And dies instantly. Shot in the head, shot in the back, dies instantly. And the police block off the area after receiving the call from the tow truck driver. And now they are pursuing an African-American man. They locate this man named Ray Crump Jr., who is...
He's
wet.
Soggy dog.
His fly's undone. His story does not match up. He's saying that he got drunk while he was fishing alone, fell asleep on the rocks, and fell into the water.
Now we have him in custody, and we have a man that comes forward saying that he saw Crump, or a man matching Crump's description, following Mary Meyer
just shortly before her death. Now, this is a murder case that would go on to be covered by many different people, time and time again, for decades. And
Her connection with the president, but also with her connection with the higher ups in Washington.
And not only that, her strange murder. And if that's where this story left off, if that's where this story ended right here, this story wouldn't have been covered by so many different people for years. There's a lot more to this, and what's going to come out in the trial is very interesting. You're going to hear reasons why the prosecution say that Ray Crump Jr. is guilty, and there are some curious reasons why he might just be innocent of this crime.
All right, we'll cover that in part two. Do we have a recommended reading?
We do have a recommended reading. Let me dig through my notes here. This week's recommended reading, we have Mary's Mosaic. This is the CIA's conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and their vision for world peace. This is by Peter Janney. And this was originally published in 2012, so it's pretty fresh stuff. But there has been a more updated version, which does include new evidence and never-before-seen government documents to further corroborate the conspiracy to assassinate JFK and Mary Pinchot Meyer. And Peter Janney actually knew Mary Meyer. He was friends with her son that was killed in the car accident. So very interesting reading.
Childhood friend of her son.
Yeah, of Michael Meyer. Yeah. Now, so you can pick that up by going to truecrimegarage.com. Click on the recommended page, and we have our books there. Just click on the Amazon banner and pick up any of our recommended reading or any of your holiday shopping as well. Kick it up to the garage.
Yeah, I mean, you can. It gives a little kickback. I mean, if you need some new stockings for, for Christmas,
for your legs, to hang in the family room.
Ladies, if you need, there's nothing better, never mind. I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so anything on Amazon, buy it. Click through our banner. They give us a little love, and we appreciate it.
And a big happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there, Captain. You looking forward to Thanksgiving? Earlier you said it's just another Thursday.
It's just another Thursday.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping for turkey as well as a honey-baked ham and plenty of beer to go with it. Maybe a Dallas Cowboys victory, Ezekiel Elliott, like 300 touchdowns, if that's even possible. But big happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there. Be safe, be good, be kind, and don't litter.